This topic for today is Deep Ecology, number 5, The Real Work, Eco-Action, and Transformation. Some of you have been with us earlier in the week, and you've heard kind of where we're at. We'd like to do a brief synopsis of kind of what we've been up to so that you can have a sense of where we're going to be tonight, which is looking at some eco-action projects.
Our view of spiritual ecology is our own personal view. Probably idiosyncratic, probably. We don't talk exactly the way other people do about this topic, and probably other people are not claiming that they talk the way we do. We're not trying to give you an exclusive view. This is certainly not the only way to talk about it. But it's the way we've tried to engage in the process of living on the earth as if the earth mattered. We take a praxis perspective. Praxis is one of those theological seminary words that simply means action. And the process is to engage in some sort of action and then reflect on it. Think about it to try to find words to express not only what we've done, but the whole experience, how we thought about it, how we felt. What it leads to next. A lot of our ideas are tentative. We don't claim to have any final answers or final formulations about this. We just like to share our thoughts and also to hear your responses. One of the things that has shaped the way we look at the world is that we moved from northern Minnesota, which was a very almost pristine wilderness area, to the inner city of Chicago, which is certainly one of the more damaged ecologies in the world. And we found that we see God's creation in Chicago as well as in places like Itasca County, Minnesota, and Holden Village, and the Glacier Peak Wilderness area. Let me give you our idiosyncratic definition of deep ecology. We see it as a path for personal growth and a path for personal transformation. And not only that, but a path by which we can transform systems of human oppression and of oppression of other organisms in the biosphere. And the way this transformation can come about is through a deeper involvement in relationship with other beings. Not simply thinking about it, not simply acting, but being involved on multiple levels in a very meaningful way. Our attempt is to experience our embeddedness in creation rather than to stand outside and try to look at, criticize, manipulate, dominate, whatever one does to things that one sees as not oneself. We see ourselves as deeply interrelated with the rest of creation. And that kind of seeing requires, for us and I think for most people, a real metanoia, a real opening of the heart, a real sort of extension of oneself to the rest of creation. And we see that opening as a key to deep ecology. Again, to living on the earth as if the earth matters. Another thing that I think is important is that we approach these issues as contemplatives, and at least for me, and I think George would say the same thing, a lot of my process of conversion, my process of to in a relationship has come from the experience of sitting in silence and waiting for creation to speak and for God to speak. And a lot of that means not only opening, but undermining our own preset agendas and preconceptions, which can be very difficult and sometimes also uncomfortable. During the week, and this is our last night, for those of you who are keeping score, we've talked about what we have done as a species culturally to alienate ourselves from the rest of nature. We've talked about our progression from a hunter-gatherer species to a Western industrialized society that is for the most part very cut off from the rest of the world. We've talked about the fact that in the Christian traditions, the writings and the body of knowledge of Christian contemplatives offers us a way to engage ourselves, a way to open ourselves, and to reaffirm our sense of belonging in all of creation. George has talked about some of the new scientific paradigms that offer us ways to understand how we are more deeply embedded in nature than we realize, and that kind of scientific understanding goes all the way from physics to modern psychology. We've also talked about how patterns of relationship at different levels can lead us to either destructive action or healthy action, either destructive ways of relating or healthy growth facilitating, affirming ways of relating. And tonight we're going to look at how this opening of the heart can lead to individual and systemic transformation through one or two specific examples of eco-action that have sprung from a spiritual core, from people's sense of spirituality and what is holy and sacred.
Are any of you from Minnesota? Is there any Minnesotans here? Okay. Good. Well, my apologies for my map of Minnesota.
It's not Estonia.
But
we didn't claim to be cartographers.
Do any of you live in northern Minnesota? I know some folks live in the Twin Cities. Anyone live in northern Minnesota? We're going to talk about an area of northern Minnesota where we lived for 5 years, called Itasca County, Grand Rapids, Minnesota was the major county. And I was on the advisory board for environmental matters for the county board of this county. One of the progressive things that Minnesota does is it has an advisory board in every county with regard to environmental matters. Now, the key word here, of course, is advisory, right? Which means we can advise all we want, and the county board can do pretty much what it pleases. But we managed to raise some issues during this time. I want to set the context for it because Grand Rapids, again, given my horrible math, the Mississippi River runs through Grand Rapids, and just north of Grand Rapids is the Laurentian Divide, which is a natural dividing point where everything north of that flows into Hudson Bay, and everything south of it flows into the Gulf of Mexico. So we're really literally upstream from everybody there. I mean, which is a very, I mean, it's nice to say we're upstream from everybody, but people there also felt a certain kind of obligation to kind of take care of that, because we know whatever we do, somebody downstream is going to have to deal with. And so during the time that I was on the environmental board, there was a proposed a high-level nuclear test site maybe to be placed in Minnesota.
Not test site.
I mean, dump site, storage site. Now, you may remember Minnesota's one of the few states that kind of went against the conventional wisdom back in the 80s. It went for another party. And so there were some folks who thought there might be some vindictiveness at the national level. But basically, the United States needs to have a nuclear dump site on east of Mississippi. And because the West has said, we don't want any more, we got enough, you know, out here, and we want stuff, we want something. And so Minnesota was being cited as one of those possible places. There's also a plan for a low-level nuclear waste dump. There's also plans proposed for a tire recycling project that was very problematic. There's also plans to convert a lot of the national forest to tank training ground. I'm trying to think, there's some other project. But there was just lots of stuff going on in this beautiful country that was kind of rolling across there. And part of it was the lure of jobs, because people were very poor. For those of you who've been to Jim and Nadine's class on racism, they talked to the fact that the sighting of toxic waste dumps is much higher in places where people of color live. It's statistically proven. Mm-hmm. But I think also where people are poor, and there were jobs, you know, always promised in the rural areas, which are really struggling in northern Minnesota. Bribes. But even when there weren't things, and we're going to talk about two things where there weren't even jobs, proposed as coming with this. But there were two actions that I'd like to focus on tonight that had to do with people of faith coming together to deal with environmental issues. And we operated out of a different kind of place. Now, I don't know if any of you do community organizing in your churches or do other kind of community organizing, but you know, there's a kind of model where you kind of polarize the good guys and the bad guys, you know, you kind of develop issues, and it's a very effective way of mobilizing people. Well, the methods that were used in these situations kind of came out of a different place. It came from Christians who are contemplatives. They come from people who are, in this case, there were some Buddhists involved, and there were a number of Native Americans. Now, in the first situation, there was a plan, there's a big snowmobile trail. Now, some of you may be snowmobiles, it's a lot of fun. But there's this big snowmobile trail across all of northern Minnesota. And there was one section between some lake systems. It was called the Rocky Gorge. And for those of you who've been in the Boundary Waters, you know how beautiful that is. This looks like the Boundary Waters. This is a magnificent place. And rather than routing the snowmobile trail a little bit further north, they decided to make a little bridge right across this only place that was just spectacular in this canyon. And so a lot of people really worked against that happening.
And they said it was going to be okay because it was going to be a very tasteful bridge.
It's like tasteful rape.
Yeah.
Well, again, I mean, I think part of
like it.
Yeah.
Part of it is look at this issue of balance, but part of it, I think, also has to do with the fact that there's so few places. How can we deal with our real human needs and still have the places that are so unusual? This is one of the very few places in the Northern Minnesota like this. And what happened was the impulse of a lot of people was to want to have a special ceremony. To dedicate this place back to God's creation, and so a Christian minister and a Buddhist monk and a Native American elder all agreed to be a part of the ceremony to dedicate this place back. Well, in Minnesota, the folks who control us, I call the Department of Natural Resources, the DNR, their stance was, this has no official standing. when they publicly came out about us doing this, they said there's no, and of course it had no official standing. It had lots of standing in the hearts of folks who were involved in this process. And sure enough, what happened was that we had a ceremony where the minister prayed and dedicated this land back, and then the Buddhist priest did a dedication, and then we had to wait till the next morning because, for the Native American elder, there are certain times of day when certain ceremonies take place, and that can only be done in mid-morning. And so the elder had a pipe ceremony. Those of us who were able were at all three ceremonies. And I should mention that at the end of the ceremony, I think I've talked to some about this before, is that the sacred pipe of the Native American people is never joined. And so if you ever, except during ceremonies, it's a very, for any of you who have decorative pipes, or if you see them in the museum and they're joined, that's really a sacrilegious act. I mean, Native American people who see that, their hearts are really wounded by seeing that pipe being joined, because the idea is it's the male and the female coming together, and the pipe is only to be fully functional at very sacred times. And this elder did us a ceremony in Ojibwe, and smoked the pipe, and he finished the ceremony, and he said, the Great Spirit accepts what we do here, an eagle will fly from the west and return. And just a few seconds later, a bald eagle came up to us and flew over the ceremony and returned. Very powerful experience. And I'm trained as a scientist. I'm trained as an experimentalist, originally in physics and in psychology. And I have a hard time describing that kind of thing. It's very, very mysterious. But here was an example, I think, of people who are operating out of a sense of wanting to be a part of helping God's creation to be more whole. And you can argue whether we're misinformed or not. I mean, you know, I'm sure there were some snowmobile folks who were really angry with us because of the fact we were going to cause some inconvenience because they're going to have to go a bit further north to do their thing. And I don't say it was right or wrong. I mean, I'm just saying, you know, that's kind of where our hearts were. That was a very important opening for me to see kind of how we joined together and how, in a sense, creation responded to us. Huh? I mean, there was a sense of something much bigger, kind of the big seminary word is the numinous, you know, the breaking through of God, of the spirit of creation in very unusual ways happened. I mean, I think this is the miraculous in life. Well, a bit later, a few years later, in this kind of ongoing progression of bad decisions or bad impulses at the state level, a site a little bit further south, that was in Hill City, which is a really small town that's close to Mississippi, was put on a list for medium-level toxic and nuclear waste dump. This was an area that's part of the aquifer for the Mississippi River. It's almost all wetland, and it was maybe maybe a mile from the Mississippi, but it's all wetland between the Mississippi. It was clearly part of that aquifer, and some Native American people, when they heard that, said, you know, this is a sacrilege. I mean, here we are. Here's a part of creation that's part of this Mississippi watershed, and they're talking about putting, you know, hazardous materials here, essentially in a swamp, in a wetland, and so we need to do something about it. And so, folks talked with other people, and what happened was it was decided that people would inhabit that site until they took the site off the list. And so a group called Camp Thunder Hill was born. And what happened was some people moved onto that site, and people inhabited that site for it must have been close to 18 months until it was finally taken off the list. Now, I want to point out a couple of things. First of all, that the impulse for doing this came from some Native American people. And again, with what the kind of thing that the Dean and Jim were talking about, it was really important for us as Anglos, as white folks, as white Europeans, to respect their agenda. In other words, they're the folks that have the agenda, and part of our understandings are to come into being with those people, with the Native American people, to not try to take over the agenda. And that's the way that that we approached being with them. So they named the agenda. The agenda was, we will inhabit this place, and we want to develop a practice, a kind of an ongoing practice to stop this from happening. And, you know, involve letter writing, involve a lot of the kind of things that are usually involved, but also involve a lot of spiritual practice. Some of the spiritual practice had to do just to sit around and tell one of the stories about how important this land is to us. And again, you know, the Native Americans don't have a corner on the sense of place in Minnesota. A lot of, you know, just I think there's a lot of folks here in Washington State, you know, people have a real sense of this is a very special place to live. And whether, and so there were foresters who were involved in this process. There were other non-Indian people. But the point is that part of what we did was we told each other a story. We told our stories about the struggles we had, about what it's like to live here, the challenges we have. Because again, you folks who come, you know, live in the Northwest know very well how much of a struggle there is between survival oftentimes in rural places, and, you know, and these other kind of choices about having the environment not be as great as it might be. So part of that was really being compassionate towards one another and towards the struggles that we have, because they're not easy choices. I mean, it was easy for me to talk about clear-cutting or not clear-cutting here, because a lot of it is dependent on it. For folks who do, and towns do, it gets very difficult. And so part of our practice was not to blame other folks, was to try to see what the struggles were within the hearts of the other people who might, how could someone come to a decision of saying, this is a place we want to put hazardous waste? I mean, how could that happen? I mean, what could be in that person's heart that could lead them to do this? Well, you know, so what happened was there was a lot of storytelling. One Native American, I don't know if you know AIM, it's a pretty controversial group, not played up highly in the press for their spiritual activities, but there are lots of traditionalists within AIM, and they donated a teepee to this camp. And so there was a lot of Native American support from many different sources for the camp. And what was interesting to us was that about this time, the politicians at the state level, they wanted nothing to do with it. There was, you know, like most things happen, the newspaper all came, people came the first couple of weeks, and then they got their story, and then it kind of fell off the end of the back pages. But the folks still stayed, and still stayed there. And about midway in through this kind of occupation, and by the way, we could have all, you know, any of us who were standing there could have been arrested at any time, because we were kind of, you know, we're trespassing on state land, so it was civil disobedience. But it was, and what happened was that this was about the point where the high level nuclear waste dump was being possibly sited in Minnesota. So all the state level politicians became real interested in what we were doing at that point, because they didn't want this. They didn't want to have a high level dump in Minnesota. I mean, no one wants a high level dump. I mean, it's, we're talking about 50,000 years and, you know, lots of stuff. I mean, it's not just, you know, digging a hole in the backyard. I mean, you're talking about 10 years of bringing, you know, tractor trailer loads of hot stuff into your, you know, into your neighborhood. So, at any rate, so they became very interested in what we're doing, because they thought we might be useful to their cause. And we said, you know, yeah, we think we need to figure out ways of dealing with this high-level waste too, and we're concerned about it being here, because again, they're talking about putting it here at the Laurentian Divide, essentially, which means if you put it on one side of the divide and there happens to be leaks, you're going to be kind of potentially be affecting this whole southward flowing aquifer. And if you have problems to the north of it, you're going to be dealing with this whole northern place. It wasn't such a small place, we didn't think, to possibly to have this happen.
And the other thing was that the ground was so unstable. I mean, when people went to set up the teepee, it took hours of searching to find a place that was dry enough that the teepee would stay up and not sink, you know?
So
that was the other thing that was really very strange.
Our tax dollars at work.
Yeah, yeah. So But what happened was, that what I'm trying to say is that, again, you know, I've been involved in organizations where the media spotlight hits you, and all of a sudden, you know, you have these kind of these immediate superstars develop out of it, you know, and people really run with the media. And it was just fascinating to watch the folks. Again, we were on the edges, we were on centralist development too. But the people who were really key to this, the people who were the folks who spent most of the time there, they weren't affected. I mean, they weren't affected by the media in that way. They said, I mean, they were very, you know, they were very compassionate, they were very caring, they were very direct. They said, yeah, we're concerned about these things too. But you know, our major concern right now is what's going on right here and now. And so they didn't get pulled off center when all the state politicians and all the media came back at this time. And sure enough, you know, what happened was they deferred the decision, I think, as best I know, they still hasn't had a decision hasn't been made. So stuff's all kind of sitting in the, you know, close to the places where it's being produced, the nuclear weapons plants and the and also the power generating plants. Until the decision is made, but again, the media came and then dropped off the back page. But I think the point is that people weren't pulled off center. I think the reason for that is there was a shared spiritual practice of telling stories, and of praying together, and of having a real center in concern about the earth. But go ahead, we had a question.
Yeah, just one question I have, and this might be real. Obvious or something naive, but you mentioned before, who could pick a site like that? I mean, real honestly, pick a site like that and seriously consider it. And you said, what were they thinking? Now, in your comings and goings with these people, you probably met a few of those decision makers. What were they thinking?
You know, no, I didn't meet decision makers, but the sense I got from the folks who were on the camp was that they chose this place because people were poor who lived there. And they thought that, they didn't give a lot of thought, but it wasn't well thought out. But as you know, once a decision is made, it's real hard to undecide it, because it's kind of like people would say, how could you have done that? So I don't really know. I don't.
It wasn't a lot of thought in it at all.
My suspicion is that there was a lot of political thought in it.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, I mean, nobody wants nuclear waste in their backyard. So one way to go about deciding where to put it is to figure out whose backyard it's not in, you know, or where there are the fewest backyards, you know.
Or maybe they said, how far west can we have it and still have the east of the
Mississippi? That was the other thing. I mean, it's a mile from the Mississippi, right?
But it's east. It's real, because we sure don't want it close to where the population is. Uh-huh. And the law says we got to have it on the east side of Mississippi. Okay. The scribes and the Pharisees come out and they look for where's the piece of state land or federal land that gets on the right side of the Mississippi. As far west as we can get it. And there it is.
And it's going to make as few people scared and angry as possible.
Yes. Because and of those people, very few powerful. They don't look at what the earth is there. They look at the population map.
Yeah.
Probably down Washington, D.C., a little conference room with maps and stick pins.
Well, I think the other thing, if I could answer.
Sure.
But there's been a systematic approach to the wetlands in the United States as looking
just
at
it
as not having any benefit.
Yeah.
And so what a great place to dump something else or destroy some more wetlands. Yeah. I don't think they even look at them as what they do for the river.
And I hope you hear that part of the struggle for Nancy and I and for the other non-Indian peoples is how to be in solidarity with those people. Or how to be in solidarity with the people who have inhabited this place a lot longer than non-Indian people have. I mean, one of the really wonderful things about northern Minnesota is, I mean, there's still towns up there with the board sidewalk. I mean, they're kind of going fast. But I mean, a lot of that part of the world was only inhabited by Europeans after the turn of the century. And so it still has that frontier kind of quality to it. And the folks who've got the wisdom of having been there for many, many generations, and as well as some of the folks who were part of this project, who were third generation northern Minnesotan, non-Indians, part of that was respecting the agendas that our Native American sisters and brothers were developing, was to kind of be with them And, you know, not to be uncritical necessarily, but to be very respectful of the fact that this was their, you know, this was a thing that they had initiated and we were asked to participate in, but not to be, not to take it over, not to run with it. And, you know, I just want to tell you a brief story that we like to do an exercise if we have time, good time to do an exercise. An example of a kind of process that we had. Because, I mean, basically, you have to think, I mean, our major action there was kind of being together in a place where people didn't want us to be. And kind of, you know, I mean, if you want to use some of Pauline language, kind of being fools for Christ. I mean, we kind of sat in a swamp for 2 years, for 18 months. I mean, you know, that's kind of a pretty weird thing. I mean, it wasn't like we were fighting bulldozers or weren't doing anything dramatic. We were kind of hanging out together in a place where people didn't want us to be, and we were kind of pointing out a really awful decision that had been made. And the way that we hung out together was to really share community across religious, very profound religious and cultural boundaries. And so, you know, and again, there were many, and much of that had to do with our sharing our stories and with our praying together. And the thing that came to mind as we were planning to do this workshop, that came to mind as the most powerful experience I had during this time was being at Camp Thunderhill on New Year's Eve. And New Year's Eve in Minnesota can be pretty cold, and it must have been like 25 or 30 below. And we were in this teepee, in this place, and had a good fire going, luckily. And the decision was made by the Native American people. The folks in the camp were given a bear skull by some other spiritual elders. And they said, you know, what we need to do is we need to, you know, the bear is a symbol of strength and stability and power. And we want you to have a ceremony and to bury that skull on the site. And so we were asked to participate in that. And so those of us who came from the Christian tradition said our prayers, and then our Native American friends said our prayers. And together we buried a bear skull at 30 below. It was teepee in the middle of the swamp in northern Minnesota. We could bury it because we had a fire pit going there. Otherwise, we would have had to use dynamite to be able to bury it. And but it was a very profound. It was profound to me that people were willing to share that kind of sacred space of theirs with non-Indian people. It was also, a way for us. You know, for me to go deeper in my spiritual journey, was also a way to have, I think, a very powerful kind of action. Now, my worldview, my theology is not such that I think that burying bear skulls has a causal relationship with state bureaucrats changing their minds about things. But I do think that that act of community, in prayerful community, was a very powerful statement, and I think it reflects this sense of interconnectedness amongst all beings. In this case, people who've had very rough times together, white folks and Indian folks in northern Minnesota, and also people who are Christians and who are traditionalists. So I hope you have a flavor of this. I mean, the quality of what happened, not only ultimately did they take this thing off the list, which was what we prayed for, but the process of our being involved with this didn't degrade us as human beings. In other words, sometimes I've been in fights doing community organizing where we won the battle, but I didn't feel so good about myself as a human being because I really ended up objectifying others in the process of winning that battle. And in some cases, I'm still not sure it was a bad decision. I mean, because there was such incredible suffering going on that needed to be dealt with. But I also say I wish I had the wisdom to have done it another way. But this felt very clean. I felt it was a very, it was because at no time did we end up objectifying what one community organized terms would be called the enemy. We clearly had enemies, but out of our practice, I think we had some glimmer of love for them, most of the time, which was very interesting. Well, do you have any questions about what we?
Sure. No, I can appreciate how you can do this as a lay Christian, lay person. Within reason, you're sharing among neighbors, and you're being tolerant and trying to find common threads. Taken to an extreme, if somebody came up with a voodoo worship, I mean, you already mentioned you've got a wide range. You've had some Buddhists and others who are certainly not traditional in the Christian hierarchy. You know, we just barely crossed the town to talk to the local Jewish community, which has such long roots in our own tradition, and yet now we're being cross-cultural, cross-religious. If we go to the extremes and have, maybe perceptually extreme, voodoo or the devil worship, sort of stuff, by other people's definition. As a clergy, I know historically I had difficult times trying to even be ecumenical. I was chastised for crossing the street and talking to the Catholic priest. I can imagine the difficulty that would come down on the head of local clergy that would attempt to be involved in such things as this. Mm-hmm. Lay people often are given, although officially we're all, you know, supposed to be the same within the Lutheran Church, it ain't so. In practice, the different standards is imposed on the clergy. Mm-hmm. Would you say that's a fair characterization, and how would you as individuals?
Well, I can say, you know, let me throw a couple of things. Okay, first of all, I was a layperson, and now I'm an ordained United Church of Christ minister. And what I can also say is that I think part of having compassion for others is to figure out how to be helpful in your own context. In other words, if I were a United Church of Christ minister in Grand Rapids, Minnesota, there isn't a UCC church there, unfortunately. Good Luther Church, I say, not a UCC church. I would have thought, had to think very carefully, because not only self-protectively, but also about would I be doing damage to my community of faith. Now, what I can tell you is that Chicago's a whole different ballgame, and I'm involved a lot with interreligious dialogue. I mean, that's an area of my interest. And we're currently involved with the Council for a Parliament of World Religions, where they celebrate the 100th anniversary of the first coming together of the world's religions in 1893. And we have people from Baha'is to Zoroastrians who are part of this community. And what I can say is the kind of issues you've raised are issues that were raised and have been raised as we've gone along with this kind of discussion. Is we're looking for people who are people of genuine faith, people who are, I'm trying to figure out how to put value judgment, but people who are about finding points of intersection, not trying to mix religions. There was part of this process is to figure out how for me to go deeper as a Christian. I hope you heard my talking about that, is that these kind of experiences helped me to realize more deeply how I'm embedded in my tradition by kind of seeing the other, and the points of intersection and the points of difference. So I think, for me, the points of discernment about how to deal with crossing these boundaries had to do with my value system and my behavior and my ethics. So, for instance, the examples you give of devil worship, or things—I mean, those kinds of practices are practices which lead to a code of ethics and a code of behavior that I find totally unacceptable. And so I would push that apart. What I know is in my contact with the Judeo-Christian tradition, with many native traditions, with the Zoroastrians and the Baha'is and the Buddhists and Hindus and all these other folks, in other words, what comes out of those traditions are tremendous amounts of intersection with ethics and behavior. And so I think that's the way that that's the kind of way I would answer, would be looking at those kind of points of intersection and how we can learn from one another. I mean, I learned a lot from my Native American sisters and brothers about how to be a Christian activist having to do with environmental issues. And what one of the things that they've helped Nancy and I do is to transfer the understanding of the city. So some of you said, part of what I think we've kind of jarred people a little bit is, as a lot of folks thought this, we were going to be talking about deep ecology as being stuff that only happens in the woods. You know, and what we've come to understand is the deep ecology we have to deal with, that we're called to deal with, because we keep being called more and more into the bowels of the city, is to realize that the beings that we're called to be deeply embedded with and deeply caring about are the poor of the inner city. And these same kind of principles about our not standing outside, about opening ourselves to the other, you know, fit every bit as much in the inner city of Chicago as they do dealing with the destruction of other kinds of beings in northern Minnesota. So I know it's a long-winded way.
Can I say a couple things about that too? I think part of the answer to the question of, you know, how could a minister do this and not compromise his faith, his standing with his congregation, so on and so forth, was that the notion that we as a country might choose to pollute and poison the entire Mississippi River Valley and the Gulf, you know, was so alarming to the community and resonated as sinful and as unholy with so much in all the traditions that were involved, in this case both the traditions that were involved, that it was seen as something that people could get behind, could understand, that was holy work. And I think that was one thing that was helpful. You know, the sense that Christians and traditional Native Americans both saw this as a spiritual issue, and that strong statement, but many people could resonate with it as a spiritual issue and something that needed cooperation. I think that was something that was very helpful. As George said, that there's the ethical issue of, you know, can you, should you, as a religious person, endanger that many people? You know, or endanger all the Canadians between us and the Hudson Bay. You know. So I think that was one thing that was helpful. The other thing that occurs to me is that for the last 3 years I've been teaching, I teach in the School of Professional Psychology. I teach people who are earning master's and doctorates in clinical psychology. And we're in a non-sectarian, private, freestanding professional school without any religious affiliation whatsoever. And I've been teaching for the last 3 years classes on the psychology of religious experience. And one of the things I require my students to do is to engage in some sort of spiritual practice while they're in my course. I can do that because it's an elective. They're not required to take it. And I don't specify what their spiritual practice has to be. And I've had in my classes Christians, Jews, Buddhists, Christians across the whole spectrum, from fundamentalists to very liberal. And what we found in talking about our different experiences of spiritual practice in a respectful way, and the person who articulated this most eloquently was a very conservative Christian. And what he said was, you know, I find that having spent time each day in my own religious experience, in my own tradition, I am more sure of what I believe, and at the same time, less disturbed when my friends disagree. He said, I realized that it used to scare me when I got into a religious conversation with one of my good friends who's an atheist. And now it doesn't scare me anymore because I'm more secure in my faith. So I don't know if either of those things says anything to your question, but...
Well, no, I'm interested because you're pointing to the ecology that may be possible for us to work in city settings where 80-90% of our population live and where I assume most of us live. And that is going to be more difficult. We will be running into a great variety, not just the Christian, not just the Jew, but we will be having this tremendous variety of people who have chosen all sorts of expressions, as well as I think in a sense maybe the atheist agnostic is more difficult, because I'm really not sure if they're denying there is such a thing as a spiritual quality, how then do you touch it?
Well, I'm a psychologist, so I look at projection and denial, and these say, there's always been a lot of energy into this sphere of life called spirituality. Now it's negative energy, but that's suggesting to me there may be some openings of the heart that may be lurking right below the surface that maybe we can kind of gauge around. So I agree, yes.
So the commonality between the Chicago experience and the Northern Minnesota experience is the choices that were about to be made or have been made are so repugnant as to allow people to galvanize against them. And in the inner city, you have drugs, you have the racial separation, you have the missing African American male, you have all of that stuff, you have the homeless, you have the homeless youth, the homeless children that can allow people to galvanize around that. And I would submit that there are people who will come from a negative perspective to draw into that, and that is where the Satan worship comes in. But there needs to be a positive force in there, and that's where we come in. And if there is no positive force, then the energy is going to go in a negative way, and that's where the Satan worship is going to come out. And that is where the gangs are going to come in, and that's where they're going to grow, and they're going to become stronger and stronger and stronger. And if we can put in a positive direction for those things to flow, that will win out in the long run. And we need to be part of that. And you can do that in your local church. You can do that by sending money if you happen to be gifted in that skill, or going down to the homeless shelter and spending a night there, or bringing food there. And that can be something great for the children. It's one of the things our family does on Thanksgiving. We go down to the homeless shelter, and we spend Thanksgiving at the homeless shelter. And that becomes a high point of the year.
Well, in part, let me kind of amplify what you're saying, because I think that, you know, part of what we're talking about here is going in the deep part, you know, the deep part is, the title has to do with not standing outside of that process. And so when you volunteer to go and be a part of a dinner or to serve at a shelter or to be involved in a food pantry or and, part of it is to figure out ways of your engaging in that process where you don't stand outside of it. Because to the extent that you stand outside of it, you're not deeply and compassionately engaged. It's not possible to, by definition. And again, I think the example I gave earlier this week is we have a dinner program that most people call soup kitchen, because the people who come there are mostly poor, and they look poor, and we serve them. Luckily, we have a much better cuisine than that. I tried vegetarian food. Oh, I have a privilege. Let me tell you try to serve vegetarian food to folks in Uptown, and you want the clamor that you get from folks here looks like nothing. And I said, where's that meat? There was no meat in that meat. And I said, okay. I thought those lentils of, you know, sash, no. Well, but so I got a low rating that meal, let me tell you, for that dinner. So I'm better than ever. But part of that being in that kind of meal, and part of the hospitality, again, Nancy works with a group of sisters and other folks in the South Side, so she always, part of the hospitality is to realize that we're not, you know, that we don't define ourselves as being separate from. So we have people coming from partner churches to help us. Sometimes we have a lot of volunteers, and people say, well, too many volunteers, I don't need to do. I said, well, you can have dinner. Now, come have dinner. I mean, you know, this is a dinner. Everyone comes to the table here. We all come to the table. We share food together. We all sit down together. No one hides in the kitchen. And that's one of my big jobs, is to kind of, you know, extricate people from the kitchen so they don't hide behind the, you know, it's a sit-down dinner. But the idea is we've attempted to blend the folks who are traditionally the people who are servers and the people who are traditionally those being served. And what do you know? And guess what happens? A lot of people who've been regarded as victims, who first came to the dinners and didn't do anything except sit there and some of them complain, waiting for the dinner to arrive, now help sit at the tables and do cleanup and do other kinds of stuff. And because, you know, this word empowerment is such a, you know, a cliche now, but kind of growing out of this sense of our being in this together. You know, and the folks who stuck with us, some people couldn't stand it. Some of the folks who came to work with us had to stand behind that wall. And they needed that barrier because of the pain. I mean, a lot of it was because of the pain. It's like it was just too painful for them to sit down and have a dinner with that person on the other side of the wall and hear their story. And then get back into their car and get back to their $300,000 house. It was just too painful. And so for those folks, which, you know, we tried to figure out other ways of being. We lost some of those people. But the people who stayed with it and stayed with the pain and the shared stories, I mean, you know, all I can say is we're about the point this year of having to turn away churches that want to help prepare food because we have too many people who are coming to help.
Going through my mind is the following concern that we have people here who have goodwill, who want to go do that stuff, but would feel very uncomfortable making that big step. And it seems to me there's a continuum of involvement. And if you can go to the deep, deep ecology that you're talking about, that is magnificent. But if you can also start the journey one step at a time, exactly. Like a little bit closer, a little bit closer, and to be an example to your brothers and sisters and parents and children, that is good too.
Let me tell you an example of what we're doing. What our church is doing is we're reaching out to a couple of partner churches this next year, and we're saying to the partner churches, we would like, these are pretty big churches, we're saying we'd like 10 of your members to come and be members of our church for a year. These are people who are willing to take this kind of step. And what we'll do is we will use the energy of these 10 good people to help us do what we need to do here to survive, because we're always in the edge of extinction in the city, I mean the fiscal extinction. In exchange, what we'll do is we will provide a system of support and accountability for those 10 people, and we'll come back out with them to you 3 or 4 times during the year and share our experience with your larger congregation. What we want you to do is we want you to have a continuing network of friends for these kind of people who are taking this leap, so that you can find out what's going on here. Because we know that you who are living in the suburbs of Chicago have a lot of the same kind of struggles we do, maybe not to the extent that we do, but you have the struggles of employment, of homelessness, and of diversity. I mean, part of what I haven't said is that the neighborhood we work in has got over 60 languages spoken, and so, and all these different religious groups. But the suburban, you know, the a lot of these, particularly the new Asian immigrants who are within one generation are making it financially, and many of them, and are able to be, and are moving. You know, so there's a lot of diversity kind of being part of much of this. And so we're saying we'll basically be a way of your training your congregation to be about the work of the church that you're going to be facing 5-10 years down the road. So I think that's another way we're trying to bridge and offer more opportunities. And like I say, part of it, in some ways, we make a mistake when we push someone's limits too far. We don't realize. I'll do this provocatively, I hope. I should also mention we always process. So part of this praxis, Nancy mentioned, well, I'd like just to mention once again, and that is that we begin an action, because action experience to my, is so much richer than my words. Could be my words, but almost anybody's words. I mean, experience is so much richer, and then we can start trying to put words around it. And so part of what we've been doing this week has been trying to do that. But you had a question, we have one more, and then we I'm sorry we're running so, we can get through our exercise.
You touched on this at the end of what, when you were talking about your sort of your sit-in or whatever, your live-in there, and you talked about how that was not, it felt good. And most of the time when I've been in those situations, there is an enemy. And we sort of create that dichotomy, and we're on this side and you're on that side. And I was hoping you were going to say, but I mean, that maybe this is being naive, that somehow you had drawn the enemy into your camp, that somehow those people had come to dialogue. And I think that if we can, even though that's still where we fall down, because we make each other enemies and they can't hear us and we can't hear them.
To some extent, I think that did happen. I mean, yeah. Remember the part where all of a sudden the politicians want to find out from right. Camp Underhill how to fight the high level.
How to fight the feds. Yeah, they're coming over us.
But the other thing was that, I mean, occasionally people would kind of come through who hadn't been immersed in the process, and people would get very, and occasionally some of us who had been immersed in the process would get very angry about a particular thing that had happened. And I have this memory of hearing about one time when someone was really putting down the county sheriff and talking about what a jerk the county sheriff was, and how evil and how stupid and how this and how that. And when something like that came up, it was as if there was no place for it to go. You know, that someone would say, well, you know, we have to look at it from the point of view of the county sheriff, and, you know, let's think about what's helpful for us and how we might help him understand, and what do we want to do with our lives regardless of what he does with his life. And so it's like the community helped people to stay out of that kind of anger and destructiveness that is not only hard on the county sheriff, but is ultimately soul-destroying for the person who does it. And I think that's where the sense of feeling good about this came from. It's like, we can't ever control what somebody else does, although a lot of us who grew up in addictive environments, which to some extent our whole society is, feel that we should be able to. You know, we try real hard. But in the final analysis, we don't have any control over what anybody does, except, you know, ourselves.
Yeah, and it's hard to find words. It's kind of like it's a sense of, kind of like how to say it, it's a sense of sweetness. I mean, it's not, you know, oh, I really feel good about myself. It's a sense, you know, it's very wonderful and it's sweet. And, you know, just like sometimes things feel just really empty, this feels very sweet. And
it's not even as if, well, you know, look at you, now you're getting as bad as the county sheriff, you know. It's like, well, let's see what we can do to deal with it.
Which is why you need to do it in community.
Yeah.
So you can do that for each other.
Yeah, because
when that side of me comes out, you can say it comes
somebody,
down.
Somebody else can.
Okay. We have a fully functioning heart. It's like a full functioning brain before coffee in the morning. You get three or four people together, you have one functioning brain. You get together in a loving brain community, maybe you have a fully functioning heart. Huh? So the scarred parts of our hearts can be helped by the healed parts of us. Yes.
What is the ultimate solution to this problem? They need to put this toxic waste dump somewhere. And you've been successful in tapping into some inner power in that community to prevent it from happening. Everybody's breathing a sigh of relief. Oh, it's not going to be here, but it has to be somewhere. And if it goes into some other community that wasn't able to do what you did, then what is the solution to that?
Well, I mean, first of all, it's not just getting out of our backyard. It was getting out of a very poorly chosen backyard. But I think also, I mean, I think you're right. I mean, I think the root cause issues, I think we need to move to other levels too, to look at how is it we've ended up with all this stuff, and how much more we're going to produce before we can go, and on and on. I mean, I've got no answers to this, but what I do know is
we're nuclear junk.
Yeah, how can we ask those deeper questions? I mean, I think, again, the city, the questions are immediately, is where are the shelters? That's the same question. No one wants a shelter in the backyard, right? And you know, this isn't quite as as toxic an issue, but in lots of ways it is. And I think similar questions get asked about that. And so, and deeper questions need to be asked too. Again, there, it's like not only the question isn't why do we need more, you know, why does the shelter need to be here, but why are there so many shelters and why are there so many homeless people? And are shelters the right kind of response? And so I don't have the wisdom to say to you, you know, here's the solution. What I do have the wisdom, I hope, to say is here's some steps to take, you know, and however, wherever your heart is and wherever your energy is and wherever your concerns are in your life, in community to make it, begin making a difference. And hopefully, if enough people do that, we'll start asking these deep questions and we'll join together and there will be some better decisions made. By then, we need to stop.
Yes.
Sorry we didn't get there, so it's good to have you. Thank you.